History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that you're going to be disappointed if you don't hear, and you're never going to hear them unless you take a little time to listen to these stories from our veterans. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve those stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know we're in for a good one today with 100-year-old Bill Gillette of San Jose, California. They called him G.I. Gillette when he was flying P-51s with the 4th Fighter Group in World War II. But we're going to start before that. Bill, take me back to Ottawa, Kansas. You're born the year that World War I ended, 1918. I'm sure you don't remember 1918 or 1919, but you probably remember the 20s. What was it like growing up on a farm in Ottawa, Kansas?
Well, I was born in the city, and my parents were pretty well educated. They both had high school educations and were teachers at their beginning when they were married. Then my granddad, I don't know how, made quite a bit of money in the farms, and he was a livestock breeder, beef cattle and stuff. And so my dad went to help him, so we moved from Kansas City to there. When I was born, we did not have a car. I like to say that my dad courted my mother in a horse and buggy and lived to see a man walk on the moon. Those kind of things are amazing. I was farming with horses. We plowed until in 1942. I started training, and in 2 years I'm flying a P-51 in war. So the transition, how fast, how naive can I make it? I felt like I was just barely holding on by my fingertips, keeping up, which you don't know whether you keep it up. But the military training also was how long it took you to learn. I mean, you needed to solo a certain airplane, plus or minus something. And I found out later, because after World War II, Korea, then I was called back and was instructing pilots for Korean War and maybe into the Vietnamese War. And I never got qualified in a jet yet. I played golf with a guy who was in the same squadron, 334 Squadron, in Vietnam. A man from 334 Squadron came to my birthday party. There was a picture of the airplane. 334 Squadron is still flying. They were in Afghanistan. You know, he's flying a 1,400-mile-an-hour plane.
The P-51 wasn't going quite that fast. And I'm interested in hearing a little more about your childhood. I like the way you said that. You went from farming with horses to flying a P-51 in a couple of years. But as you're that boy growing up, what kind of jobs did you have to do on the farm? How hard was that work?
Well, you plow the land, you chop weeds with a hoe. So it was pretty primitive, but progress. John Deere had just built a tractor. I remember that. And those kind of things. So in the late 30s, see, I was in high school. FDR was elected president, and the Hoover era moved into the Depression. But I was in high school in 1936, a senior in high school. My history teacher said, I'm going to make a prediction. You young boys or whatever, and we were all farm kids. It's a town of about 10,000, so farmers support the creameries and sell all their products and shop there and stuff. Anyway, the high school teacher said, before you young men graduate from college, the United States will be engaged in a world war. And all of you who are physically able will be in a military uniform, fighting for our way of life, which went right over my head at 17 years old.
So that's 5 years before the war, and he was that detailed in his prediction.
Yes. And after the war, I came home and went and found him and talked to him a little bit. He said the political in the Europe was just so identical to World War I from a history point that it just could not happen.
Well, and before that, I'm sure there were some memorable times in that Depression era, because those of us alive today, we didn't live through that Great Depression. It doesn't seem like we can really fathom it. What are the things you remember about life in those days?
Well, you had food to eat. I can remember eating turnips all winter because good crop of turnips, but no potatoes and those kind of things. Struggling for food, the farm. If it rained, you could go plant some quick-growing crop, maybe, and salvage things. But it was a struggle for life. And ever being in Europe at that time would have been some crazy dream, I think I have. And 1942, I'm getting acquainted with the military, and absolutely, actually farming on a farm and working and living, I think, was harder than being in peacetime military training. You didn't get up till 6 o'clock in the morning or something, reveille at 5 o'clock. It was all through. There was beer and everything. You got, $13 a month or something? And actually, you transition slowly, but was in that same boat, kind of. We had to struggle, we had to do things, and partly the war went that way because we innovated whatever we needed. And the P-51, after I started flying in Europe, went through several major changes and suffered some pretty severe things, and then resurrected and become a bigger airplane and a better airplane, and eventually changed the war. I never gotten an airplane until I was in the Army. It started in January 1942 in the military. You go through tests. One was what a Victrola is?
Yeah.
It looked like a Victrola, and on it was a little spot on that table, was a dime, and this thing turned around like a Victrola. They give you a little probe electronically, and you had to keep that probe on that dime spot as it went around. That's one of the tests. One of the tests was you sit down like this, and there's a stick, and there's two rows of lights. They turn a light on, and you have to find where this stick turns that light out. I can see that because the control, that's very like the stick control in the airplane. Anyway, those kind of things. At the time, what is this telling them? How does this tell them? I got on a ship, and I told one of my students later, when I graduated from flying school, my uncle came around and said, if you'd go to England, I'd arranged a cruise over to England, and there'd be an airplane, and you could fly around and look at the sights in Europe and stuff like that. And, and I have no idea whether he ever learned that there wasn't any choice to the offer. You get on this boat and you go.
So the uncle you were talking about was Uncle Sam, and this wasn't an invitation. You had orders, and it definitely wasn't a sightseeing trip. Sounds like that went right over the heads of some of your students. I know you're a flight instructor for more than 30 years, but you also had to survive 59 combat missions with the 334th Fighter Squadron to do that. Were you at all prepared for what those combat conditions would be?
I had shot quail, those kind of things, but they never shot back at me. And when the second mission, I realized those little black spots are being shot at me on my second or third mission. My squadron commander was Mike Sabansky, a Polish young man, still Polish. In 1939, he sat and watched Hitler's troops march across Poland. This is 5 years later or so. He has gone to Canada, learned to fly, gone back to England, joined this non-British unit, and his squadron commander. And you think he didn't insist on my attitude being a little indignant at the Germans? I'm Greek, Steve Pisanos. A similar circumstance. The Germans did something, so he went to Canada. But he was in the 334 squadron, too. He later got shot down and joined the mafia or the escape evasion people. He says there's more action here than there is in the airplane.
We've had him on the program, the Flying Greek. He's no longer with us, but he had quite a story of surviving, bailing out of his P-51, jumping off the wing or something like that.
Yes, and his stories lived in the squadron. I mean, somebody could quote you, well, Steve did this or Steve in there. Jim Goodson, an American. He spoke French and German besides English, I think. But he was in England as a boy, and then got on a ship, started back to the United States. A German sub sunk his ship. He got on a lifeboat. The submarine serviced and strafed the lifeboat, but they didn't get him. So he's come back to Canada, and he is one of these guys. And he had nothing in mind but getting even. So my attitude towards the Germans was changed drastically. There's a fourth guy that I used. All of these guys had been there a year or so before I got there. Some of them had fought in Dunkirk. And those kind of things. They flew Hurricanes and Spitfires. They talked English. We didn't talk English. It was a kite. It wasn't an airplane. It was a petrol bowser. The information was gin and those kind of things. And something accomplished was a piece of cake. And
so you had to learn a new language.
That's right. And I found out I couldn't fly near good enough to satisfy these guys. I got there on May the 1st. Don Blakesley was the first impressive person I met. We go through checking in the base in military person, and the colonel wants to see you. He's out on a mission now. So we go up in his office, which is on the second floor, and you look out over the field. And they said, here he comes. You know, here he comes, an airplane jacked up, a white scarf flying. He's a big man. When he opens the door, it doesn't really open. Leather jacket, this white scarf. We all get tattooed. The oxygen mask comes around here. We don't wear goggles. They're up here in case we need them because of 5G churn. But we had them in case of fire. So the goggles, sunglasses were put in a pocket before takeoff and stuff like that. And thought, wow. And he takes about 2 minutes to say, I'm Colonel Don. I'm the boss. He says, I'll see you at the bar tonight. Turn on his heel and slam the door. Now there's six or seven of us brand new pilots. Sit there and looked at each other. That was a welcome introduction to the way he ran the thing. I mean, our business was we didn't chit-chat. If you saw the radio chatter on Red Tails or something, no, that's for use, you know, tell somebody to break, but don't chit-chat. And that's the way. And we might get to the target area without a word saying after we started the airplanes. Don Blakesley flew every third mission, I think. And if he liked, wanted to be on this one, why then he might walk in and say, Jim, you're off the hook. I'm going to lead this mission and stuff. I mean, he got out there. He didn't say, you go do, you follow me, and I'll take you there. And the stories, I don't know if you've heard any stories. There's stories that he come back and said to the crew chief, I got two, give them to so-and-so. You know, he hasn't gotten any yet. And remember, I didn't fly this long because he's running into limit time. They have a certain amount of time when they suspect you're getting frazzled or whatever. And they claim that he had nearly twice as much combat time as records showed.
So he wanted to stay there and fly so much that he would fudge the amount of time he had been flying so he could stay longer.
Yes. And, I mean, these are stories. I never actually ever heard him say anybody. But people say these things. I came back and take an hour off my time or something. Like that. And so impressed I was, and I still was.
So was Dwight Eisenhower, who as Supreme Allied Commander awarded Don Blakesley the Distinguished Service Cross. He also earned 2 Silver Stars, 8 Distinguished Flying Crosses, and even the British version of the DFC in World War II, one of many legendary pilots from the 4th Fighter Group. And we have the privilege of visiting with another one of them today in Bill G.I. Gillette. More of his adventures in P-51 Mustangs when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say,
I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit GoArmy.com. To talk to a local Army career counselor, call 559-323-1099.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 100-year-old Bill Gillette of San Jose, California, G.I. Gillette, as he was known to his fellow pilots in the 334th Fighter Squadron, part of the legendary 4th Fighter Group in World War II. They called him G.I. because he'd been drafted into the infantry before he ever pursued aviation. The skies suited Bill well, completing 59 missions with the 4th Fighter Group, which grew out of the Eagle squadrons of Americans flying with the Royal Air Force and ended up with more combined victories over German aircraft in the air and on the ground than any other group in the war. It was the first fighter group to escort Allied bombers over Berlin and also the first to escort the heavies on shuttle bombing runs landing in Russia, of all places.
The trip to Russia before we went, I don't like this mission. It's got showcase, you know. And sure enough, it turned out to be poorly planned or executed. We lost about half the bombers the first night. We're all in bed. We live in a, you know what a tent city is, kind of military. It's four or five guys in a tent, but they're strung so there's a street and tents on each side and ropes to one tent to guide to the next one. Reason I tell that, just about dark. It's end of June, so the long summer time, see, it's 7 hours flight plus pre-flight time, so we're all tired. The gun starting fire, well, we didn't know. The Germans had sent a night fighter troop, or they had found the airport. Night fighters lit flares, and then airplanes came in and shot up. I've destroyed about half of the bombers on that field. Well, some of the anti-aircraft guns were over on this side of our tent city, and I climbed in a sleeping bag, zipped it up, and and here goes a 37-millimeter shell right through our top of our tents, it seemed like. I don't know how I changed. I went through the war. I came home. I am sure that I had to change because one of the things, I had a doctor who came in a bar. If you didn't drink a couple of beers at night, he kind of questioned you that you needed to unload the things that were building up inside of you. Don't come home. Gosh, look how tough this was. Or anyway, he watched start contact and don't get too friendly with, you know, Joe, and Joe, don't be too friendly with him. Because if you get shot down, he is not going to be up to snuff the next day. Reverse is going to be true. Those kind of things. I kind of went along, but the years since, I've had time to think about what the transition. You are killing somebody every time you shoot down and blows up or crashes in the ground. So I didn't kill German pilots. I shot down German airplanes and tried to mentally keep that state. But the fear, I mean, everybody, you know, those who said didn't move, they're a little touched, you know. They're liable to react somehow. And the 59 missions were from about everything. I was in D-Day. I was airborne and over France before daylight. Flew 6.5 hours. Our Colonel Don stood in the briefing at midnight the night before and says, I told Ike there will not be any German airplanes coming. Our job is to fly just inside, on the German side, on the continent side of the, and down the Seine River, between 5 and 20,000 feet. So 16 of us went. So we were just on the German side of the beaches and the borders, and so that any German Luftwaffe airplanes come would have to come by where we could see them. I was 6.5 hours on that flight. Came back home. We were relieved by other people from our squadron. Then I went back mid-afternoon, something like that, and stayed till dark. Now, I understand there were a couple of German pilots in Goody Goodson, says he, but near dark, he took his wingman and got over there and didn't get shot at. So I don't know. I was there somewhere in that there as the sun was going down.
So you flew two missions on D-Day. The longest day that, you know, everybody has talked about ever since. And there's so many different elements and such a massive thing, and so many people died. But what did you see? Let's talk about that first part. When you're up there for 6 hours, you're just flying back and forth looking for German planes?
But there is a big storm comes through. The sailors were seasick, so you know what some of the infantrymen. The first mission, I did not see any enemy activity. The clouds, I couldn't see the ground. We flew headings and patterns and stuff. And I honestly don't know where I was a lot of the time. And the storm on the English Channel, I've talked to guys and they say, it was terrible. They not only weren't used to being in the water, but and so here's 40,000 people walking up that beach, knee-deep in the water. They must have been on a ship at midnight or something, and all that day. Now, for me, there was no sleeping. 5th and 6th, we went out early morning on the 5th. I don't think I would have known it was June the 5th. You know, we didn't keep track. I didn't know. I'm busy flying. I had to think about, how do I do this better? How do I do that better? Who will I fly with? How he flies? Those kind of things. See, we got up the first morning, went out on a short kind of tactical mission. I don't remember. I didn't carry tanks. On the way home, about 4 hours, there's a convoy headed southerly on up in Holland or up in that part north of France. We come home and reported that I went to lunch. And I come by and say, gee, I go back to operations, the truck go out there. I go back, there's 8 of us have been called back. And they said, gee, I, here's your 3 guys. No bombs, guns. Those guys are going back and make that convoy go away. So you see that they don't get hurt. You and your 3 guys to make sure. So we went back and found the convoy and they bombed it. And I didn't fire a shot because no Germans came up and I wasn't going to go down and strafe. I didn't like strafing. It was part of the thing, and I was lucky. But, boy, you're down there. I strafed an airdrome once, and the mechanic, if he'd been standing on the wing, could have thrown his wrench and hit my airplane. You're down 50 feet or something because you have to strafe. And those were all the things that went through my mind, and I'm sure went through other people. We'd sit around and talk about tactical things. We played ping pong in the ready room, but we were always, usually someplace, we were fighting a battle kind of a thing. when this happens, do this. When this happens, do that. Remember, the backside of your brain is defenseless. Don't let anybody get back there. And the same thing is true. The front side of your brain is dangerous. You've got to keep it pointed at the enemy and those kind of things. You know, they just seem very simple now, but I don't know that we'd iron those things out. I would have ironed those things out in time to not get shot down. I can remember the first mission. I went out, and there I am, White 2. White 1 was the squadron leader. White 2 was his wingman. White 1 was the squadron leader. White 2 was his wingman. And White 4 was his wingman, so the most experienced man in the squadron was 1. 2, now I missed my first mission, so I'm up in front, not back behind where I get picked off. So anyway, they said, we need another fighter pilot. And the only way we'll find out, because Jerry's are the best people to sort out fighter pilots.
Thanks a lot. And for people who don't, maybe they weren't around then, they don't know what you're talking about. You're saying the enemy, the guy shooting at you, they're the ones who determine which ones of you can fly or not.
Yeah. And I succeeded in coming home every day in 59 times. And we got to a point where I asked for an extension at the time. 250 hours of combat time. The bombers flew missions, but their missions were lots longer than mine. They had flew slower. They had 10, 12 hours of fuel. Needed that to do some of the targets. And problems early on as the fighters couldn't go that far. The Germans were smart enough. They knew where the lake, and up in the Hamburg vicinity, there's a lake up there. That lake was about where the P-47s and 51s had to come home. And to go beyond that, the B-17s, B-24s didn't have anything but their own guns as protection.
So the Germans knew where the escorts would run out of range and had to turn back.
Yeah, and maybe not just sit out there and wait. Yes. And then when the P-51 come out and they hung 4 more hours of gasoline on it, why, that changed. And that's so we could go another hour farther in. P-51 was a good enough airplane to take advantage of that.
And you mentioned 59 missions in World War II. And I've read some about some of your close calls and your aerial victories. But I bet you had quite a few close calls that you can look back on now and say, hey, I wasn't too far away from not coming home.
Well, that's the way you had to fly. You needed to get close enough to not miss. Our range was, the guns, 6 guns were hired, so they had a range of crossing. 250 yards was the most lethal zone where 3 guns were all aimed. First one was 225 yards, 250 and 275. So whatever errors and wobbles in the bullets there. No use shooting if you could just barely tell it was an airplane. You also needed to keep track of that guy because you maybe can't leave and reduce your force. Anyway, those were the kind of things you do. But Blakesley was quite good at keeping track of. He'd say, Deacon, do this. Jimmy, do this. G.I., do this. And he's up there looking, keeping track of where I am in my airplane when there's maybe 15 or 20 of us stewing around. Or he'd say, Jim, that's good, Jim Goodson. Take your squadron and go over and get outside of those guys and start squeezing them so they'd come by and those kind of things. So we had 2 or 3 very good tacticians, good sets of eyes, and recognizing airplanes. And that was the first thing, you know. That's not a German airplane. You learn a 109 sits nose down, tail high, like it's going downhill, just scooting across. It's a little airplane, littler than the P-51. B-17 looks like it's climbing a hill all the time, etc. B-24 formations fly loose and gaggly. The airfoils are such that they were more difficult to keep into a fortress. It'd keep good formation, but they were slow, 150 or 60. We needed to be 200 and probably flew more than 250, more than we flew less than 200. We needed to have up where that airplane was ready to go, and max continuous power was best bet. So how long the fight lasted. Sometimes he'd lose 10, 15,000 feet. I ended once with, my group came in on the right side at the IP. They turned right. So this back here came about 50 109s. There was some on the other side, but these guys got the turn. And so I was looking at my bomber. Those look like Christmas trees, you know. The one mission I ended up in, and all of a sudden, there's no airplane. There's four more airplanes, me and four airplanes. Now, those four have the wrong company logo on them. So I'm sitting there. Now what do I do? Not a P-51 in sight. We had descended out of the bomber train. The bomber was going on and their bombing thing. Anyway, this is foolish. I got to get them all on one side. So I play with my turns, and so I got them all on the left side and just turn around. All guns going in right to the four, because they're trying to turn right toward me, so they're all in front of me. And I got through and picked a speed. We had a climb speed of about 170 miles an hour, and at max continuous fire, with a 109 just wouldn't match that climb. There were other things they would do quite well. Anyway, I don't know. I never looked back.
You're a little outnumbered there. And so you flew right between them. Do you know if you hit any of them or shot them down?
No. I shoot there, but one other thing, if you keep too low, you're going to run into them, because head on, you have to shoot up here. So that's going to put your airplane in a plane where mid-air collision, and that wasn't to my liking.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't to your liking either when there was a hole in your wing and you were losing parts of your airplane. But if you're listening and you think you know what caused that, you might not have the right idea. We'll hear about that when we come back, and also about a mission in which Bill shot down two German fighters. Find photos of G.I. Gillette then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, hearing just a few of the stories from the legendary aviation career of Bill Gillette, 100 years old, of San Jose, California. Originally from Kansas, he told us he went from farming with horses to harnessing the horsepower of a P-51 Mustang. For 59 missions with the 4th Fighter Group in Europe in World War II, he shared some stories about some of his group's legendary aces, but I'm sure you want to hear about some of Bill's most harrowing moments. We're going to get to the day he shot down two German planes on the same mission. But first, Bill, I want to hear about this flight in which the only bullets flying through a hole in your wing were from your own plane.
I'm on a test flight. Deacon Hively became squad commander after Mike Sabansky was shot down on D-Day. came to me and said, oh, there's two engines to a PV-51. The superchargers are different, so the -3 engine would go 4,000 or 5,000 feet higher. It would go to 40,000 feet. He says, I want four airplanes. I want you to be one of them. I want them to have a high-altitude engine. And so when these guys come over like this and tease us, we can go up. So they got me in a fairly new airplane, somebody hand down. But they had the wrong engine, so they put a new engine in it. And I'm to fly it. Now tomorrow's the day. So they came to me and said, this airplane needs a test hop. It's had an engine change, and we can't let it go. And it's evening time. I mean, it's liable to be dark for it, you know. So you have to go up and test the supercharger, and its altitudes are critical. So I went up to 24,000 feet someplace in there. The other one, the supercharger, automatic. You could manually turn it on, but the other one was somewhat lower, and I was all in how they were geared. So I went up to 24,000 feet. This is going to be my airplane. I'd like the airplane to be smooth. Airplanes tell you a lot of things about how they're flying. They say, turn a little more right rudder. I'm going too fast. I'm going too slow. I mean, and you have to learn what this airplane is telling you. So if it'll go 350 miles an hour and it's not any buffet, so I pointed the airplane back toward home. And I was looking around. So I thought, gee, this airplane there is 350. And I looked out here, and here's a little rectangular hole in the top of the right wing. I looked over, and an M&H flying out. And I looked over at the other wing at the same panel. And it went like this, bowed, lifted up vertical here, and took the left horizontal stabilizer off. So I have no elevator. This is a new experience, too. So I thought, I got to get out and walk. So I bailed out. I have no idea, probably not four I needed to, as I watched, because I looked at the, did I bail out of an airplane before I should have, you know, because it was drifting around. Well, no, I didn't, because these pieces were found on the ground. I landed, a parachute, was a cricket field, I think, and a railroad ran along the side of the wind. So my parachute, I went under the wires along the railroad. Parachute went over the top, and I'm hanging there in the railroad about 5 or 6 feet off the ground.
Because the wires got your chute?
Yeah, the wires got the chute. And I thought, now what do I do? It's quite a drop, you know. Well, Bobby, which is an armed police in England, didn't carry weapons in. Bobby came in his car and helped me down. I don't know whether I had gotten down or not. Got the parachute off the wires. Took me to a U.S. Air Force hospital for a physical. And took me back. But that was a totally new experience. I had black eyes. I must have been doing 300 miles an hour when I bailed out. Well, what my crew chief didn't tell me before I got an airplane is the doors for the ammunition troughs for the guns had an old pretty rough style fastener. They had Zeus screws that stuck up. Well, they changed this panel and changed the fastening or something. The next morning, somebody said, you were second. There's a test pilot had the same thing happen yesterday in the United States. So I don't know, and they never told me what they did. It was like it was classified information. And maybe needed to be, because any report of speed limits would give the Germans more knowledge.
Yeah, because you didn't want the enemy to know of these newfound capabilities. You were hoping to catch them by surprise with your increased speed and range.
Yes, yes. And their speeds were, say, the difference between 400, which I had been to a time or two before. Now, 350 wouldn't cut it. You wouldn't get away, or you wouldn't catch whichever end of that you were on. If you disabled your airplane, you were in Germany, so you were sure going to be a guest of the Germans.
Yeah. Well, and just so I'm clear and understand what happened, you're saying you basically shot yourself down because these ammunition holds were not secure. The stuff started flying out, yeah, and it's what destroyed your wings.
And the air flowing over this hole created some kind of suction. And here's 50 caliber shells streaming out. They're on a chain, and they're blowing out into the air. So it didn't hit the right stabilizer, but it, the left one, and I sat around and thought, I wonder if I jerked some, changed the pitch attitude of the airplane, something if I'd have gotten by and brought the airplane home with two holes, and they'd have been able to study whatever remained. I never heard what they did, but I'm sure this is the beginning of a new series of repairing and beefing up. Like when I put the third gun in the P-51, then the wing started breaking just outside the third gun, and they had to re-strengthen that some way and something like that. So I know it went through those two things after I was in combat.
Well, and I think that's an aspect of this that we probably don't think about or talk about enough. I mean, I always think of test pilots as guinea pigs, but you're really underscoring that nobody really knew how any of this was going to work, and the way you learned was a lot of times paying with guys' lives.
Well, that's right. I mean, if the other airplane is doing better, you don't give up, and then now you find out how the weak, and you get out in the corners when you're in training. You always stay inside the little envelope and turn this way and turn to, and don't turn beyond this. When I was, first few days I was flying, they say, you got to turn tighter, you got to react quicker, you got to do this, you got to know what that airplane's got. It's got to tell you when it's about to stall. It's got to tell you when it's about to brake. I went out and practiced till I could make it 6G, 180 degree level turn and roll out with my gun sight on something. 6Gs is pretty. If the airplane won't stand 6Gs, you find out in practice area, those kind of things. And it's the same way. So you get out in the corners, you're forced to outdo these people. They're not allowed to outdo me, you know. Yeah. And kind of thing. So part of that is trying to anticipate. And I have gone out with my own squadron mates, come back wet with sweat down to my belt from the maneuvering the airplane around the sky.
Not from nerves, but from exertion.
Exertion, yes. Yeah, that's just before G-Suit said you would black out, so you had to learn to yell and tense your body so the blood didn't clear. And you could see that happening. It starts turning dark, you know. So when that gets just above your cowling, then you ease off.
Okay, so we got to talk about this a little more, because you're saying this like it's no big deal, and I don't want people to miss this, because again, talk about something we've never done. You're saying before you had the G-suits, you would start to see your consciousness fading, and kind of like a screen or an iris on a camera. Yes. It's getting dark all the way to about your eye level, and that's when you need to pull out?
That's right. And you need to have developed the gentle change, not move the control, which is release the pressure that you're pulling kind of a technique, because you can be too rough with the airplane at this time and damage and all of those things generally slowly get put into your system.
Isn't that scary, though?
I don't know. I didn't think of that way. I got to know what this airplane will do and not kill myself. An airplane flies a lot like a bicycle. It can't turn without banking. Most of my victories were involved in turning, and you get close enough and then they'll see you and turn or whatever. I don't think any one or two maybe was straight on. There is a guy flying and bang, and if you're close to clouds, people come in and out of clouds. I mean, you just can't avoid, if a puffy cloud is there, you just can't avoid, or you can't do things to avoid the cloud. One mission might be absolutely just fly around. The next mission, there'll be 100 airplanes up there.
Well, and you say sometimes there's 100 airplanes in the sky, and I understand that's the way it was on a day when you got two of your confirmed kills?
Yes, yes. There was two groups of Germans, one on each side, the big one on there, and the bomber in between was about 80 bombers.
So 80 American bombers.
80 American bombers, and probably, I would guess, 50 Germans behind me, I had to turn because people behind you can shoot you and you have no defense. And besides, if I shoot at them, they're the enemy. You disrupt their formation pattern of firepower. So you go head through them. So our tactic generally was to get between the Germans and the bombers and then at some appropriate time, turn.
So you turn right into this wall of German fighters.
Yes. The lead is going, you can see smoke and all the guns.
So you have 50 German fighters over here and another group of German fighters over there, and you're trying to protect these bombers. How'd you get those two, and how do you remember that unfolding?
In the maneuvering around, there's suddenly an airplane right there. Just go. I mean, your thumb's on the trigger, and both of them happened to the flying led us together. One, there was a little film of clouds, and he almost went out of sight, but then a bunch of garbage came out of the cloud.
Well, what does that feel like when you're flying your P-51 straight at more German fighters than you can count?
Well, I had confidence. Probably I don't remember exactly. You know, it's been 70 years. But all I had to do was hit the airplane some, and then that made him change his tactics. But I never got close enough to be mid-air worried, I don't believe, with enemy. Strafing is a different thing because the trees are fixed and the objects you strafe through and stuff like that. Strafing an airdrome, you play around in the treetops and you go out and go behind a tree so the gunner can't see you over there. And then you go up to where you could see and down and plan each. So you went this way. Go this way the next time.
So that was more nerve-wracking for you than air-to-air combat?
Yes. It was more than you. Jim Goodson, he was a strafer. Me, and he got shot down strafing. I was on that mission and talking to him on the radio. Don't go across that airport, Goody. I've been across it 3 times. And they're ready. I'm leaving. And anyway, he said, well, one pass. And they got him. I was kind of taken when Goody got shot down that day because I felt like if he'd listened to me, he'd have talked a bit, he might not have gone across the airport or something. I think Goody was there. But Blakesley and these guys all had an attitude, and I tried to fit, I think, that attitude. I was proud to be good enough to have been kept. Blakesley, if I wasn't good enough, he'd get rid of you like that. So it was an accomplishment to me to say that I was a member of the 4th Fighter Group. And when I went there, they were leading the number of kills in World War II, and they ended up with 1,000 and something destroyed. That was World War II's biggest American outfit shooting down German airplanes. All through England, Hub Zemke and his wolf pack and stuff, and he and Blakesley were kind of like that.
They were rivals?
Yeah. And Blakesley made, and the 4th Fighter Group made an attempt to not let the Wolfpack get ahead of them. We could read intelligence reports, and the intelligence man comes out and said, they got 4 on the way home after the escort, so we got to get 4 today.
And those two both ended up as prisoners of war, Zemke and Gabreski, so maybe that's what allowed you guys to pass them?
Well, the leader, there was some leader we got when Blakesley left. And they took him off because they didn't want him. And I don't think they wanted those other two guys, but the shock of them getting shot down, they sent Blakesley home. There's rumors that they're going to decide that he's too valuable an asset to be lost as a prisoner, and they're just going to have to replace him. And there, besides, physically, we aren't sure. There's some breaking place for almost everybody. I never got a bullet hole in my airplane while I was flying it. Another pilot flying my airplane, one of them escorted his bombs into the target, which is not recommended. Another guy landed 50 or 60 feet in the air and made it all up. And another guy come in, so I'm now on my 4th airplane. I said, how's my airplane? He says, your oxygen system is all messed up. What? So I go running out to my airplane. I said, what's going on, Sergeant? See that little hole? There's a hole in the side of the cockpit, and there's a hole in the other side. And then he later told me, they got the pilot back in, and they couldn't stick a dowel through the two holes that ran into his tummy. So we figured he's pulling G's, he's doing something, and so you're all pushed out of shape. And then, but that's how close he came to getting a bullet in his stomach. And it had hit the oxygen tube, which went through right up your front and up to the mask.
What would you say that personally, with regard to your years in the service, what are you most proud of?
Probably this tour, knowing these guys and being able to walk in and sit down and say, "Hi, Jim," and being treated like what I thought was an equal and not, "You're a newcomer." And I know some of them didn't get that treatment. I thought, gee, they act like, you know, it's okay for me to be here. But I think the single most thing is the fact that I developed good enough flying abilities to live with these guys in a time when the war was hectic. 6 weeks or something like that before I joined the 4th Fighter Group there, they shot down 300 German airplanes. They lost 55. And that's the reason they need replacements. So there. The second is I have 4 kids. All of them have college degrees. All of them are retired now or next to retiring. And they're financially doing well. And 3 of them are in education. Their mom was a school teacher, and they all in the school. The middle one was administration at Santa Clara University. And the other one is in Hawaii. She's a school teacher, high school teacher, and my oldest one was a speech therapist in San Jose area. And my son went to the Air Force Academy. He was a class ahead of Sully, the pilot that landed in the river. I don't know whether they knew each other, but he passed away due to a cancer.
Do you ever look at your 59 missions and say, how did I get through all those? How am I still here?
Several of them. D-Day, for instance. We lost 10 pilots. I didn't see a German airplane. The other part is these guys that were lost had strayed from our original area. I don't know whether that was good or bad, but I keep thinking, oh, Colonel Don said to guard this place, so I stay here and guard it and stuff like that. And I tried not to think about that part. And I think some of the guys are the same way. Well, this is what I'm going to do. And especially these guys who were getting even, you know. I mean, all of these guys had some gripe. Blakesley and all of those guys, some gripe against Hitler that they were settling personally. I had no idea what I was going to do until I just followed these guys. And I presume God gave me the ability to fly and see some of these things that others didn't, or I'd have made mistakes that others made.
You said God gave you the ability. Did you ever feel like God was protecting you up there?
Yes. And it would not be uncommon for somebody in briefing in the intelligence room to say, God, I know where I am. I can get home, go help somebody else. I mean, other guys, it's the same way, I think. Well, if they can feel that way, I can feel that way. And that had been a wondering point for me as we were doing this flying. My going to church and being a Christian, what's that going to do? How's the war going to look at this or anything? And other guys, I mean, I was amazed when I was sitting there and we were talking about something. And Shoki or somebody said, I just stepped and said, God, I could see England. Go help somebody else for a while.
Well, and you're 100 years old now, but you're still driving and you're still golfing. A lot easier to shoot your age when you're 100, I'm sure. What keeps you going? What's your secret?
Well, part of it is I try to keep going. There are days when I think, gosh, I don't even want to get out of bed. Good genes, I'm sure, are part of it. My dad had 2 sisters who lived past 100. Beyond that, I don't know, but I think there is a supreme being. I don't know, we're getting to be so many of us, how he can take care of everybody anymore.
Well, aren't we thankful he's still taking care of Bill Gillette, 100 years old and closing in on 101. As you might imagine, with such a distinguished career, Bill had a few stories that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time today, but I do have them bonused in for you as part of the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find some photos of this amazing aviator. One more note, you may have noticed we have a new sponsor helping to make this program possible. I'm very excited to partner with the U.S. Army, and of course we're thankful for our men and women in uniform today, who just like those we hear from on this program, are willing to put their lives on the line for the rest of us. Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear it can't be done and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. If you think you have what it takes, you should find your place on the team. If you live in Central California like I do, you can call 559-323-1099 to talk to an Army career counselor. And of course, wherever you're listening today, you can contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.